J'ai beaucoup
Thank you very much for coming
de chance
tonight.
que vous
I know that
encore
everyone has a lot to do, so I'm very grateful that everyone is still awake and that everyone's brains are still working, because you're learning a lot here, you're being exposed to a lot at this festival.
Imprévision qui flotte sur cette
There's a slight element of doubt, as it were, for today's lecture. There'll be a military parade happening today. As you know, Metz is very important to France's military, and there actually will be a military parade that will go by, so we may have to interrupt the talk at a certain point because there'll be a fanfare and a parade and everything going by.
À bas voltage, qui est
My music is often at very low low volume, and in fact I'm often called Gérard peu de son, Gérard very little sound. Music which really has nothing to do with military brass band music. I'll try to not exceed my allotted time slot, and I will hope that we'll be able to stick to the schedule. This is a lecture, and I do have a basic plan, but I will digress quite a bit, because my remarks today are questions more than anything else, questions that I ask myself, questions that I will ask you, and
si cette intervention, bon, conférence, c'est peut-être un peu formelle, mais
this lecture is perhaps not the right word. Perhaps remarks would be a better word.
Pendant les sessions de travail,
is about
je trouve que ça serait bien,
what we composers often grapple with. And I think that I'll pick up on some of the issues that came up in the meetings that I had with some composers here at the festival. I think that it's useful to think about that all of us work as composers. The way we write music, our own compositional methods, this is something that we're constantly asking one another about. And with the utmost humility, I would just like to raise some of the issues that come up when talking about the way people write music. Now, the name for this remark, I'll try to explain it somewhat. That'll be a rather uphill battle, given that I chose this name quite a while ago. Of course, people who organize these events often ask us to give the title for things before we really even know what we're going to be talking about, and I think this was also the case this time. The title is Autofiction, Character, Portrait, and Substratum in Musical Writing. Now, that sounds very, well, intimidating, a bit abstruse and academic, but it really isn't. What I'm essentially doing here is asking the following question, asking myself and you the following question.
Notre manière d'écrire la musique.
What is our writing? How do we write music?
Qu'est-ce qui est à nous,
and what in our musical writing belongs to us? What is something that is borrowed from others? What is something that has been transmitted to us? These are all questions that don't have clear-cut answers. But in any case, I want us to concentrate on these types of questions. Is writing music a bit like writing one's own destiny? Is writing music like painting one's own portraits? If you look at the list of works that you've written, and as you get older, this list of works is longer, and it's a bit like an old winter coat which gradually gets heavier and thicker. When you look back at this list of works that you've written, can you actually look at that and say, that's me, that is me? Or is it just a kind of echo of the world around you, of your personal environment, the people you've met? That's a question which always comes up in learning how to write music. What belongs to us and what is taken from others? It's not that we need to claim ownership on ideas, but the idea of artistic provenance is nonetheless essential. Now, I'm not sure if I'll do this in a very organized manner, but in any case, What I'll try to do here tonight is to approach this idea of the musical idea. What is a musical idea? Is it something pure? Is it something inherited, secondhand? How do we experience our own musical ideas? I think that from a certain standpoint, you need to love your musical ideas. Love them like children, in fact. Adopt them sometimes, just like you adopt children.
Et vivre avec ces idées
you need to live with these musical ideas,
vivre aussi avec
and
les idées
living
avec
with them,
autres.
Of course, also implies living with the musical ideas of others. That brings me to another aspect of the title, the idea of personality or person and portrait, and then the idea of substratum
or
a layer underneath.
Sur cette partie de ma musique qui est faite de la musique des autres.
And tonight, I'd like to concentrate on the aspects of my music that are taken from the music of others. That is one part of my musical language, but it is not all of my musical language. If you were at the opening concert of the festival, I assume that you heard our score, Bruckner's score, and my own, the piece called Wunderblock. This piece, Wunderblock, belongs to what I like to call my own preliminary archaeology, the idea of approaching a father figure, the idea of going, delving into memory, and to treat that memory of this father figure as a type of material. It's not an objet trouvé, it's not a found object. Be it Bruckner or other composers, all of us, of course, have works that have influenced us to a large degree. Now, in my own personal case, that's Bruckner. People are often surprised to hear that my music is influenced by Bruckner, since it's often so fragmentary and is often played at such low dynamics. But I think it's important not to take a simplistic approach to all of this. In Bruckner's music, I have found, and many people indeed have found, that there's a kind of
noblesse dans le traitement du matériau,
of nobility, a kind of elevation in the spiritual sense of the word, which is very unique in music. In fact, the other day I was talking to Olga about this. There's even a kind of madness in Bruckner. There's a quote from Luigi Nono that I like a lot, and he said, "This demon is one that needs to be followed." Or rather, that one needs to follow one's own demons. And Nono was one who did that. Bruckner was one who did that as well. That made life rather difficult for him, but despite that, he was able to create a body of work which is extremely important. Of course, I'm not really sure if there's any relation between Nono and Bruckner, but in any case, back to this idea of the musical idea. This is a very difficult idea to grapple with. Often, what one feels has been invented, what is new, is in fact not new. It has already been written. It would be, of course, naive to say that all of us are sitting down to write something completely new and reinvent the wheel. Rather, we're simply doing something which is necessary. And this is very different from writing something which is entirely new. And nevertheless, it is obvious that as a composer and as an artist, which is as an artist who is part of a cultural environment, who has experienced a wide range of cultural experiences, and given our heritage and our artistic background, we often fall victim to knee-jerk artistic reflexes. This is something that, of course, you have seen in your own writing, and something that I experienced in mine. This problem of being stuck in preconceived notions, stereotypes, often we are trapped by stereotypes. I often think this distinction, however, between avant-garde and academic writing is misleading, because I think the very idea of avant-garde is itself an idea which has become completely, which has completely fallen by the wayside, in a sense. It has been completely, it's become dated, in fact. So I think things today are far more subtle, far more complicated, and that's why some of the artistic debates, which have taken place recently really are non-debates about non-issues.
Que ces stéréotypes, ces poncifs,
sometimes I think the stereotypes or the kind of preconceived notions or these gimmicks, I wonder how we deal with them, and I wonder how the interpreters are going to deal with my very complicated speech.
Au fond, on peut se dire que
but ultimately, dealing with gimmicks and stereotypes, dealing with them directly is a way of neutralizing them.
And
this is something that I often have done myself in the past.
D'écouter ce qui est un stéréotype,
namely, listening to what is seen as a stereotype, and then
pas du tout avec mépris,
to approach it not with suspicion and not by looking down at it, but to look at these stereotypes and have some affection for them. To look at a type of musical gesture or a musical phrase or a chord or whatever it is, and to have a kind of affection for it. These are stereotypes, these are things which exist already. We can make them part of our music in a positive way, without any kind of negative attitude. That, however, does not exclude taking a critical approach to them. And here, critical doesn't mean being completely impartial. This critical approach means carefully selecting amongst different objects or stereotypes. By my very nature, because perhaps I'm a rather skeptical person, and through my personality, I'm a rather reserved person. And that means that sometimes I prefer keeping a certain distance to music, and thus have kept a distance with music which is not my own. As a result, I am rather suspicious of the quote-unquote goes without saying aspect of musical expression. Of course, as musicians, we express ourselves. But saying that itself is already very simplistic. Expressing oneself simply means saying what one feels is too simplistic. What we're doing is far greater than that. It is broader in scope. It has to do not just with us, but with others as well. Saying that we simply express what we feel would mean that we are alone in our destiny. I think art is more subtle than that. And I think music is the art, more than any art, which thrives on free associations between different elements. More than, for example, poetry. Or rather, it is poetry which also thrives on these types of associations. I think association is the key word for poetry. And if you look at the word compose, you can see it as composing music, but also composing an assemblage of objects or fragments. This is something which comes up in my discussions with Mario. We all really like philology, Mario and I. Now, the word compose can also mean, in a sense, at least in French, it also has the meaning to cope with. Now, sometimes you're stuck in awkward social situations, you're spending an evening with people who bore you, and you have to find a way to cope with that. So, you can also see compose as a way of coping. Coping with what? Coping with oneself, and coping with what one has inherited. A kind of mass of things, and of course also coping with the way that you relate to others. The worst in musical composition, of course, is misunderstandings. We want to avoid misunderstandings, but misunderstandings can also be used. Misunderstandings can, in fact, lead to understanding if they're treated correctly. This is perhaps a bit complicated, but I think misunderstandings are something which can, in fact, link up to everything which is great and everything which is painful about writing music.
que Jean de La Fontaine, le fabuliste français, compose.
Now, if I could ask La Fontaine, the famous French author of fables, to ask another fable, I think I would have asked him to write a fable called The Cuckoo and the Beaver. Now, why those two animals? The cuckoo is one of the only bird that takes the nests of other birds and uses that nest as his own. It steals the nests of other birds. So I kind of like the idea of a musical cuckoo. I am a musical cuckoo. I have made my own nest in other musicians' nests. And perhaps even I will make a nest out of what have you have told me about your own music, because I think you can't teach someone without taking something from them. So I've given you something, but I also have taken something from you. And therefore, I'm a bit of a cuckoo, if you will. Now, the beaver is another animal, as you know, which builds its home in a river with bits and pieces of different types of wood and material. The beaver, using this mass of collected objects, manages to build a very solid house. What I like about beavers is that they're very patient. They're wise. Beavers are stubborn. And I think you need to be stubborn in art to be able to follow one's dreams and follow one's demons, indeed. And beavers are also very clever. This is, of course, necessary. You need to be sly in art, not just to deceive others, but to deceive oneself and to overcome what one thinks one would have been capable of, and thus to carry the listener further. All of that by way of introduction. This was a rather long but necessary introduction. And here come the fighter planes. Here we have a demonstration of French military strength. I hope you're all very impressed. I hope that no live ammunition will be used. Right, I've gotten through the first page. That means we are moving forward indeed. I'll be basing my remarks on a number of musical excerpts. I've planned a great number of these, but unfortunately I don't think we'll have the time to listen to all of them. When we do reach the end of our time slots, I will stop. I will end on time. I won't have a question and answer session after this lecture, but this is because the talk itself is composed of questions, but I do hope that what I say today will lead to lively discussions later on, either later today or in the days that come in this festival. I won't have time for your questions.
Je voudrais rappeler avant de commencer cet exposé,
my remarks, I would like to recall
de Roland Barthes,
principles that I call the Barthes principles after Roland Barthes. He had two basic principles that he talked about a lot, especially in his first lectures at the Collège de France. I was there myself, but I can't remember exactly when it was. I think it was in 1976. Some of you probably weren't born then. Now, what he says is that the person who speaks only knows slightly more than he who listens. And in fact, the speaker often knows less than the listener. I think that that links up to my own idea of what a composition teacher is. You teach best what you don't know. And that has a name, that means searching. Roland Barthes is a thinker that I like very much.
He felt
that our destiny is composed of different types of knowledge, and he did a lot of wordplay with the Latin word sapienza, which means knowledge. And here is Barthes' quote, which we all think need to engrave over our bedsides. No power, some knowledge, and the most savor, or savoring as possible. So all of our work as composers and as painters and poets, because as composers we are also painters and poets, is to remember that we are also translators. And that brings me back to our friends who I admire so much in the interpreting booth, the work that they're currently doing to communicate with you and to give you my rather confused thoughts in a language that you understand. So back to the composer. What composers do is translate, and this is something that you saw in rehearsals. Sometimes our scores are not enough, and we need to do some simultaneous interpreting of our scores. Of course, saying that music is the universal language is false. Music is not a universal language. At the beginning of this list of musical examples, I'd like to have us listen to a bit of music by Froberger, Johann Jakob Froberger, a great composer, born, I believe, in Düsseldorf. I can't remember if it's Düsseldorf or Stuttgart. In any case, born 1616, died 1667. He had a major influence on keyboard writing, especially German and Italian keyboard writing, but in France as well. You can see Froberger as a kind of pre-romantic Baroque composer because he really introduced the idea of play into his music, and that brings me back to autofiction and portraits. We'll be listening to a very brief excerpt, about 2 minutes, of a piece called Memento Mori, Meditation on My Future Death. It's a rather unusual topic, but he also wrote a number of unusual pieces on,
par exemple, il écrit une partita pour faire passer sa mélancolie.
A number of pieces that express his melancholy and a number of his other emotional issues. I think the French equivalent of Froberg can be seen as Couperin. Couperin is a composer that I really like a lot. Sorry to give you all my personal taste. I've already revealed Bruckner, Froberger, and Couperin amongst my deck of personal musical likes. Now let's see if the musical example can be played.
Vous avez entendu des modulations.
What you just heard were some incredible modulations. It's really great music.
La musique des autres, moi, m'a servi parfois de laboratoire.
The music of others has served as my own personal laboratory at different points in time. How can I say this?
À cultiver une certaine.
The music of others has helped me develop a kind of critical distance to music as a whole. And it helped me avoid what Adorno called an infatuation with musical material. Composers, all of us, are often obsessed by musical material. Of course, We are right to see musical material as important, but you need to be able to rein in this musical distance, this musical material, because otherwise it becomes a sort of wild horse that will drag you away and will destroy everything that could have been pure in you. Now, I'm not against material as such, but it's important to treat material carefully. Everyone's musical curiosity is part of who they are, and here I have to admit, one of the worst musical sins, which is the sense of being obsessed with the past. I don't know if you've ever been to Egypt, but profaning the past is something that did occur to the tombs of the kings in Egypt. Now, I'd like to have you listened to two examples of my own music, what I called Nebenstück, kind of side dish, a musical side dish, as it were. And what I do with these Nebenstück, which were commissioned by people in Germany, is to...
Alors, par exemple, je vais vous parler de la Nebenstück 1 que vous entendrez jouer par
le best way of putting this.
Par Pierre Butrieux samedi.
You heard a number of remarks about the
simplement, j'ai eu toujours cette impression que la
Nebenstück in the Fragmente Stille in Die Atoma and its connection to a Brahms opus 4. Now, I've always been
ce que nous croyions inventer,
rather
pas inventer des choses, mais était extrêmement proche
amazed by what our memory is capable of and what memory can do. Now, what I did was take this score, a score that I hadn't listened to or read through in about 20 years, and I thought it would be really interesting to pick up this score, which is a very beautiful score. This particular score, in fact, is a Brahms piano ballade, which he wrote when he was very young, the piece that I based my Nebenstück on. I thought it would be interesting to see how my own personal musical memory of this piece. Now, again, as I said, I hadn't listened to it in a very long time. I wanted to see how my own musical memory of this piece would relate to my own compositional process, my way of shaping musical material. What I wanted to see was how these two aspects would coalesce together. Now, all this may seem relatively unimportant, but I think it's essential. There's this metaphor of an object which has fallen into the sea. Now, picture, for example, a shipwreck. A boat sinks, falls to the bottom of the ocean. Centuries later, you find an object which was in that ship, and that object is completely oxidized or entirely covered by coral. Now, what's interesting is that what covers the object both hides it and reveals its form. So what I did with this piece of Brahms was to subject it to my own personal acoustic treatment, my own way of thinking about sound. Pulled out of this music, I underlined it in my own way. So what I'd like to have you do first is listen to the original, the Brahms. Let's see if I can properly deal with this machine.
Just a little fragment, but I'm sure you remember it. And now I'd like to play it for you with my own particular recipe. It's a bit like Wunderblock, but slightly different for Wunderblock. But this here, the aim was
qui aille chercher la musique qui est derrière tout.
To find an instrumental way of seeking for the music that is hidden. You know, in Beethoven, for instance, you have two musics at the same time, the one which he is writing and the one which is in his mind.
Si vous pouvez pousser un peu. Dans cette expérience-là aussi,
when I was doing this work,
les interprètes,
and working with the interpreters,
parce que, au fond,
I was doing something that I really liked to do very much.
Derrière, mais aussi
I wasn't simply looking for the music that lies behind what I'm doing, but I was looking for a music that is far away. And I think that's part of our job. Try to get something which is very far. It's a sort of a feeling of an epiphany. When you look for something that is very, very far away, something that is very fragile and that gives a different result. I mean, the aim is not, of course, to give Brahms a new life which he doesn't have anyway. It's a way of listening. Of sort of
alors,
shifting our way of listening. Now the second
Nebenstück,
which is also a commission, I think, from the
Cologne
Orchestra.
Un projet un petit peu plus compliqué.
That was a rather more difficult project. I don't know whether you remember that Rauschenberg, the American painter, in 1953, had damaged a painting by Willem de Kooning, and he had replaced it by his own. The difference, of course, was that de Kooning was agreed to this, while Bruckner, I'm afraid, I couldn't even ask him whether he was or not.
So, le projet est un petit peu différent dans le Wunderblock.
My project was slightly different from what it was with Wunderblock.
Je vais essayer de l'expliquer, mais c'est assez difficile.
It's not very easy to explain.
Je crois qu'il y a, j'ai pratiqué une certaine, ce que j'appellerais la magie par le vide.
That what I tried to do was a sort of magic due to a vacuum, through a vacuum, silence in other words.
Silence,
you know, you've got to really sort of stare at something to be able to see it. And it's the same thing with your ears. You've got to really stare with your ears to manage to catch a few sounds. And it's a bit ambiguous because this sort of magic through a vacuum with Bruckner, you're sort of in between two things. You're moving from honey to poison, something very sweet and something extremely dangerous. I mean, it's really dangerous. And Wunderblock, well, how would we translate Wunderblock? Olga, can you help us? How can you translate Wunderblock? A block of wonders or what?
C'est en fait something like that. Machine un peu
Actually, it's a kind of a little machine, and not a very efficient one, that Sigmund Freud invented in 1924. And I'm not going to go into a whole description. I've never tried to use it. It no longer exists anyway. It's a way of writing.
Comment? Ça existe encore? Ah oui.
Oh, it still exists, really. But where is it? Where can you see it?
On le voit comme un objet de musée.
But you can see it in a museum.
Ah oui.
Oh really? Olga, I'm sorry, we can't hear you.
Il faudra qu'on fasse cette recherche alors.
Well, I'm gonna try and see what I can do about that then. Anyway, it's a way of writing where you have a piece of celluloid and a piece of see-through paper that you put on a piece of resin. So you write with a sort of a stiletto.
C'est-à-dire qu'à la fois dans un même mouvement, on écrit et on efface.
In other words, when you write and you erase at the same time.
Freud se méfiait de la mémoire. Essayer de trouver
Freud was
pareil,
very careful about memory, you know. He was trying to find something analogous to the system of perception which does not keep its results but it, that disappear, but at the same time it records it.
C'est le maestoso de la sixième
so
symphonie
this
de Bruckner.
Is the maestoso of Bruckner's sixth symphony. And as very often in Bruckner, you have very soft strings at the beginning. So just to remind you of how it goes.
Non, alors ça c'est pas ça c'est. Je vous propose maintenant le début
so
de
now,
propre version.
I'd like to play the beginning of my own version.
Une pièce avec un accordéon soliste.
I wrote this is a piece with a solo accordion.
Dans cette idée de Wunderblock, il y avait aussi
in the idea of Wunderblock, there was also the idea of turning this magic music into something of the world of childhood. I don't know whether you heard in the concert, there were sort of music boxes, there were also glasses, there were decoys that imitate birds.
Et j'ai fait une translation qui j'espère n'est pas pris pour blasphème.
I did a sort of a translation, if you like. I hope you won't find this blasphemous. You know that Bruckner was an organist and a very religious.
Je donne une version comme ça, un peu plus populaire et surtout un peu plus portable.
Say a more popular version and one that's easier to play because a child doesn't have an organ in his room. So the world of religion is replaced by a harmonium. You couldn't hear it very well at the concert. You can hear it better here. It's an electrical organ that's rather awful, but it still gives a sort of a kitschy feeling to it.
Alors, attendez. J'ai étiré souvent les répétitions, parce que Bruckner se répète beaucoup.
Often sort of dropped a certain number of repetitions because Bruckner repeats a lot.
Le fait que j'ai étiré
Now,
les dimensions, c'était pour mettre en valeur que Bruckner ait vraiment été parfois un répétitif. En fait.
Show that Bruckner, in a way, was a repetitive composer. You know, he used these sort of panels, sequences that kept sort of revolving on each other at the end. You find the same thing with another great Catholic composer, Messiaen. You often worked with sort of panels like that.
Now,
another way of seeing this way of trying to incorporate, to use something that already exists, that's tropes. You know that in the Middle Ages, trope was a way of using something that's pre-existing and using it as a basis and then sort of drawing it out, changing it, adding sometimes words to the music. That was often done too. Now, there was a project that was suggested by Recherche, an ensemble. They wanted to commission a certain number of composers. I think Olga did it too. Chiarino did, Fernyhove, Wolfgang Riem. I'm forgetting lots of them. There's Schulhorn too. There's anyway, they all wrote a piece. They were entirely free with what they were going to do. There was no rule. There were no rules. Simply, you had to use in some way a certain cantus firmus. So I wrote the little piece which you heard yesterday, if you were there. It's very short. It's called Rebus.
Utilise donc les 54 notes de ce thème innominé.
Uses the notes of the theme in nomine, which comes from Taverner's Mass, which was written around 1528. And the Cantus Firmus, we don't know why, was used a lot during the Elizabethan period, but even much later, lots of composers like Richard Strauss, for instance, used it. And recently, there was this idea of asking a certain number of composers to write something on that basis. Now, what I'm going to play is very simple. I use one C sharp in the very low register, but aside from that, I use all the notes, only the the notes of the mode en D, that is the in nominé, and a certain number of aggregates, but always on the white keys of the piano, with little holes between these aggregates that allow the cantus firmus to stand out. And it ends rather quickly, like a sort of a humming, a sort of a funny little song, so as not to end really like a Gregorian chant.
Ensuite, autre manière de faire
then,
des tropes, donc comme je vous l'ai dit,
another form of trope.
De deux manières.
As I said, there are two ways of writing a trope.
C'est-à-dire qu'à partir de
you had
paroles,
the ones which started
culte,
from worlds, from words,
générer,
words of the mass,
aussi,
which on which you could generate a melody. But then you had the logogenic
text.
Tropes where you added words to music. This was done for a very long time, the 15th century, the beginning of the 16th, and very often they even used unreligious texts, I mean lay texts, texts of songs, which were put on to a religious cantus firmus. So I wrote this other Nebenstück. It's a Nebenstück, but I would say it's a trope, because there the aim was to add words to a piece that had already been written.
Aussi parce que je l'aime, mais pas seulement pour ça, mais parce
piece,
que cette œuvre est devenue,
like
comme il arrive parfois de certaines œuvres, un peu chosifiée. C'est-à-dire qu'elle est devenue
sort of
un stéréotype
reified.
De la beauté musicale.
Sort of a
je vais parler de l'adagietto de la
musical beauty. It's the adagietto of Mahler's fifth,
particulièrement
which became extremely fashionable because of Visconti's movie, Death in Venice.
Il se trouve que dans ce
it so happens that in this particular a project which I call Kein Deutscher Himmel. I'll tell you why. The Venetian idea was very important. Martin Kaltenecker, who's a German musicologist but who lives in France, found texts under Mahler's music, which I wrote for a chorus. I wrote it for a chorus, but he found texts of a poet, August von Platen, who is not an extraordinary poet, but he lived for a long part of his life in Venice. He was an aristocrat, a nobleman, and
il est mort à 39 ans en 1835.
When he was 39 in 1835 in Syracuse, and he died of cholera. Now, you may remember that Aschenbach in Death in Venice also dies of cholera. And it so happens that von Platen had gone to Italy because it was, how shall I put it, one of the places where he could express his love for boys, which was not easy for an aristocrat at that time. And you know, of course, that Aschenbach was also extremely struck by the beauty of Tazio, a young man, if you remember the short story. And Thomas Mann, who wrote Death in Venice, wrote his first dissertation on August von Platen. So you see that the whole thing is sort of all mixed together, all woven together. And there are texts that come from von Platen's diary, and when he reached Venice, his first words were, "No German heaven, kein deutscher Himmel." He had at last been released from that heaven that he'd known up to there. So
I think one could consider that what I've been doing
is a form of manipulation. I would call it maybe even a post-synchronization. You can often say that it's a rather exaggerated karaoke.
Alors, c'est pas ça du tout. Alors, attendez, c'est pas grave. On va pas s'énerver.
We're going to hear it soon.
En
it's just to help you remember.
Donc vous, j'insiste sur le fait que j'ai
so I do want to make it quite clear that I chose this piece, of course, because I love it. But, you know, if you go to Venice, you're going to hear it everywhere in all sorts of forms. So mine is just one more among many. It's a bit like Vermeer's, the painting by Vermeer where you have a woman pouring milk, and you can get that on all the yogurt boxes. So it's a way of using something, but with a great deal of respect, with a great deal of love.
Vous remarquerez que j'ai utilisé un mot allemand.
You will notice that I used a German word
au début
for the harp
part
at the beginning. It's gondola, a gondola, just to give the idea of the rhythm.
And that recalls
the beginning.
Bogart arrive comme ça sur dans la. Dans la ville de Venise.
Of a movie when someone arrives in the city of Venice.
C'est des Français, ils prononcent très mal, on comprend pas la langue.
Of course, in French, they don't say it quite right, you don't understand.
Thank you.
Voilà, je parle maintenant de substrat, ce que j'appelle le substrat, c'est une chose qui est à l'origine d'une autre. Par exemple, on peut dire que le latin est le substrat de l'anglais,
de l'espagnol, de français, de français.
En chimie aussi, le substrat, c'est une...
is
un élément sur lequel un autre
the element
va réagir. Et au fond,
or with which another one reacts.
Enfin, d'ailleurs, j'ai remarqué que
and
le
that is a part of my work. I discovered, by the way, that the words used in chemistry, you should have a look at that, it could be very useful to us. Often we don't have the words that we need to explain our word, work. And in chemistry, there are a number of terms that are very useful. You should have a look at a chemistry dictionary. And a dictionary, you know, isn't dangerous, contrary to test tubes.
Il y a évidemment dans le substrat, je parlais de la langue, la question de la langue, basis, changer la langue sans changer le langage,
changing
de a
language or changing speech without changing language, that was Mallarmé's aim, and change speech to change speech means to change the world. So there you have Marxism, and all this is a link.
Le substrat peut ne pas être musical, mais peut-être enfin,
other than musical, it can be literary. I wrote a piece in 98, which is called Bruit sans diviser, which is a tribute to Vinteuil, who was a composer who counted a great deal for me. He's not really real because he's a character in Proust,
pourtant, but c'est un artiste fictif, mais
he's a character,
enfin, j'ai fait
an artist,
sur
a character, and I thought a lot about him, and I've thought a great deal of his work, which we don't have, of course, but
Maurice Rabinovitch,
and then Maurice Rabinovitch, who's a filmmaker, had suggested to some composers to make a film searching for Vinteuil's sonata. It's a bit much, really.
Il avait proposé à plusieurs compositeurs,
he had suggested this to several people, Marius Constant, Philippe Ersant, and myself.
Que fait,
and
Proust
he was suggesting to look at the descriptions in Proust of Vinteuil's sonata and to write music on that basis.
Cette chose très excitante.
I felt that was really quite exciting. I'd never thought of working on Proust. I mean, for me, Proust was essential for my work.
Mais finalement, j'ai relu les descriptions, non seulement
finally,
les descriptions
I read those descriptions, not just the descriptions of Vinteuil's sonata, but also of his septet, which he wrote at the end of his life, and which was heard long after his death. You know, Vinteuil was simply a piano teacher in the provinces, and he's only discovered after his death. It's then that they discover that he was a great artist. So, on the basis of Proust's description of Vinteuil's music, he speaks of purple fog. He speaks of two notes that keep coming back, which you'll hear, by the way, and the sort of melancholic, constant movement, motifs that every once in a while appear but can hardly be heard, and then they disappear. There I really had the feeling that Proust was talking about my own music, perhaps not very modest, but still. He speaks of liquid, of silence, of infinite pain, and of a pain which is mitigated. He speaks of cold, of sound changing at every moment, that disappears to become shadow, and all the way to the very soft background, which is similar to some of Schumann's pieces. So, I used two instruments, violin and cello.
Un seul instrument. Vous verrez
but I wanted to turn them into one single instrument, and you'll see that they both play in the same register. No, no, that's not it. Oh dear, what have I done? This is not it.
Voilà. Ah, c'est donc les deux notes qui reviennent. dans la description.
Those are the two pitches that come up all the time in Proust's description of the music.
Quand je réfléchissais à Vinteuil, qui l'aurait pu être.
When I was thinking about Vinteuil, and of course we need to keep chronology in mind here. If you think about when the narrator was born, the narrator in Proust, of course, who is Proust really? Proust here, we Proust really does autofiction better than anyone else. Vinteuil would have been born in 1840 in Proust's novels. Now, in my own personal imagination, I see Vinteuil as a kind of Scriabin, but of course that. Historically doesn't work out in terms of the dates. I also wanted to point out to you that this idea of using pre-existing musical objects is something which has always existed. In fact, this was something which was far more common in the Baroque era, when lots of composers copied works and took up the works of others. This was a way, in fact, of spreading music about, especially operas. I think it would be interesting to write a history of music from that standpoint, looking at how musicians recycled the musical materials of others. The cuckoo technique, as I mentioned at the beginning of my remarks. The cuckoo takes another bird's nest to lay her own eggs. So stealing the nest of others is a way of ensuring that your species survives. There's another way of appropriating others' musical materials, namely sampling. I wrote a piece called Gigue. This is a piece for six percussionists. In this piece, what I wanted to do was picture a kind of different way of using technology. In this piece, the performers use objects from daily life, including tools like and household objects like razors, flower pots, saws, drills, etc. Useful objects that have a purpose. And this is something that comes up with Boulez when he quotes René Char's idea of an useful object and the idea of artisanat furieux. So this piece was written for a specific event. It was written for a party. It was a bit of a musical joke. And as you'll hear, I'll have you listen just to the beginning of this piece. You'll hear that this isn't just a sample. It's not a very sophisticated sample. What I wanted was to have a kind of patched together feel, a bit like the sculptures of the Swiss sculptor Tanguy, who's built his sculptures out of random things that he found lying about. So in this case, we're not patching together a Bruckner symphony. What we're doing is we have one of the percussionists operating a
évidemment le hasard. Mais
operating a record player.
Une courte double page.
Rather,
mais
sorry.
Vous entendez, vous ne reconnaîtrez pas que c'est Mahler, mais
the piece is in A minor, and thus it picks up elements of the Mahler.
Ça c'est un marteau, donc.
Here there is the sound of a hammer, like marteau sans maître.
Voilà, Mahler.
There's Mahler.
Sixième.
That was the razor. That's just a short excerpt of the piece.
Pas très long, par ailleurs.
The piece itself isn't very long, actually. In the introduction to my presentation today, I was talking about this idea of the idea, which I find so very important.
What
is an idea? Where does it go? Where does it come from? All of that is always a very fragile and fascinating process, which has a direct connection to things that are fragile and sensitive within us, within our very being. Often ideas are dropped.
Je pense que vous avez tous parlé.
I'm sure you've all had this experience. In your own work, as composers, I'm sure you all have sketches of things in your archives that you've decided to drop, things that never really came to fruition. Do ideas have a second chance? Do abandoned ideas have a second chance? That's a question I decided to ask by using some of my own abandoned ideas, using the ideas of someone else, namely someone that I no longer was. It's a way of reworking the same material. Now, my English is pretty shaky, but there's a Glenn Gould quote that I really like. Glenn Gould hated concerts, and he liked recording studios. And he didn't like concerts because there was this idea of no two-takeness, the idea that a concert didn't allow you to rework certain passages. He was absolutely terrified by the idea of doing things live.
Je me suis donc demandé comment faire une partition avec des idées.
So what I did was decide to see how a score could be built up using ideas that have curdled, ideas that have gone bad, abandoned ideas.
Qui ont été éliminées.
Ideas that
donc j'ai écrit
have
une
been
pièce qui s'appelle Mes Béatitudes.
Culled. So I wrote a piece called Mes Béatitudes. The title is a reference.
Je dirais Saint-Sulpicienne de César Franck, qui s'appelle.
It's a nudge-nudge, wink-wink reference to César Franck, who wrote a piece with a similar title, Béatitude.
Dans une ce que j'appelle une forme traversée, une sorte de narration de l'échec.
I built up a kind of narrative of failure. It's a series of ideas that never came to fruition. And when you put these failed ideas, when you line them all up, in fact, the piece works quite well. Therefore, I think you shouldn't throw away ideas that haven't worked out. They can always be useful later on. And that brings me back to Tong Li, the Swiss sculptor, this idea of recycling materials that have been thrown out. Therefore, you always need to love your musical ideas. That's something I tell my students. You need to be loyal to your musical ideas, even bad ideas,
because
a mother loves her handicapped children as much as she loves other children. So this piece, Mes Béatitudes, was a way of breathing new life into musical ideas that had been put on the ice, that had been chucked.
Donc, je vais vous faire écouter le tout début.
So I'd like to have you listen to the very opening of this piece, Mes Béatitudes. There's no formal structure here to be recognized because the model here is myself, a failed version of myself.
C'est pour trio, accord et piano, j'ai oublié de dire.
For strings and piano, forgot to mention that earlier. I'm really not very good with machines. I'm not sure if we've gotten to the right point. As it turns out, in the middle portion of the piece, there's a kind of quote. I wouldn't really call it a quote, but a sort of intertextual reference. It's a reference to Bruckner. This reference to Bruckner is a kind of reworked version, as you heard in the Nebenstück. It's a kind of reworking of the second movement of Bruckner's Seventh Symphony. And this is one of the melodies that I find, I think this is one of the most beautiful melodies ever written. As you'll see, the melody emerges gradually, and then there's a sudden silence. The melody isn't woven into my own musical material. It is external to my own musical material. It is isolated and fragile. By the way, I asked the performers from the Recherche Ensemble not to play this melody well, not to master this melody, but to play it in a very fragile way, something which is ephemeral and fragile that you're grasping between your fingers.
Là, c'est ce qui précède la citation, le hors-texte.
The intertextual reference.
nous entrons dans cet espace où il y a la...
That brings us into this area with the reference to Wagner, the kind of monument to Wagner. Rather, to Bruckner. The interpreter apologizes.
Je vais vous parler d'une autre partition.
I'd like to tell you a few things about another one of my pieces, a more recent work. I can't really remember when I wrote it, 3 or 4 years ago. It's called Cassation. It's a piece which goes with this last piece that I just talked about. It's written for the same instruments plus clarinet. This piece stages a rather unusual encounter between the memory and the subconsciousness or the involuntary, something that Proust himself was very interested in. In this work, I establish a kind of correspondence between something I was working on and a short Wagner piece, which is very unknown. This is a piece drawn from the notebooks that he had while he was working on Tristan.
Et il l'a offert à sa femme, Cosima.
Wagner worked on this piece and gave it to his wife Cosima as a present in the winter of 1882 when the couple was staying near Palermo.
À un moment, je me suis aperçu de cette coïncidence ou au fond de cette réminiscence.
When I was working on this piece that I was writing, I noticed that there was this resemblance with this small Wagner piece. I recognized this resemblance and decided to acknowledge it. At the end of my piece, Cassation, the strings have been playing without their bow through the entire piece. At the very end of the piece, they pick up their bows and play this Wagner theme. And strangely enough, this Wagner theme also relates to the last scene of Visconti's film. The speaker can't remember the title of the film, but the film is about the King Ludwig of Bavaria. Now, what's the word for that? The speaker is trying to find the word. Yes, Ludwig of Bavaria was, of course, a very generous patron of Wagner.
J'ai lancé un appel, mais qui est resté muet jusqu'à maintenant. Donc, on va entendre cette fin.
So we'll listen to the end of the Cassation.
Mais non, c'est pas du tout ça. C'est un piano préparé, hein.
Paired piano.
Je vais vous faire entendre le début de Cassation.
I'd like to have you listen to the beginning of Cassation as well. The beginning of Cassation is not someone else's music, it is my own music. However, it does borrow some things from others. Now, it doesn't just borrow form, because cassation is based on an 18th century form of divertissement music. But this beginning of cassation expresses the idea of saying goodbye to someone who's leaving. I wrote this piece, and today I listened to it as a kind of serenata toccata in a dream that I had. This dream is somewhat difficult to explain. Now, as you know, toccata originally was a type of tuning piece. You check the tuning. So you're checking tuning and playing at the same time. That's the idea of a toccata. The idea that I had was that the performers were rehearsing at the same time as they were performing. They were making their way through music. They were feeling their way through it. And that's why the string players don't use their bows. They use their string instruments almost like a guitar, either using a plectrum or their hands.
On pourrait dire que c'est une...
I guess you could say that
braille auditif surtitré.
It's a kind of a kind of musical porridge which has subtitles.
Simon Taille appelle la mutilation qualifiante. C'est-à-dire on a
a kind of musical braille where people are feeling their way through the piece. And when you're blind, of course, you have
sense du toucher exceptionnel.
You have one less sense, and blind people often have a sense of touch, which is far more sensitive than our own. So that was something I also wanted to evoke in this piece, with this idea of braille.
Les sourds sont tristes et les aveugles sont gais.
And another cliché that I wanted to address in this music was the idea that deaf people are sad and the blind are happy.
Je vais terminer.
That brings me to the end of my presentation because time is running out.
Vous devez avoir faim.
You're probably all very hungry as well. I'd like to conclude by talking about one of my more recent works called Rouscousse.
Cette idée de l'indexation.
In this work, I tried to go further with this idea of indexing the ideas of others, of lining them up, the ideas of others and one's own ideas.
Poétesse américaine.
I came to the idea of this work through rereading the works of a contemporary American poet called Susan Ho.
Traduit en français qui s'appelle Marginalia de Melville.
She wrote a book which in French translates to Melville's Marginalia. And what she did was look at all the comments that Melville wrote in the margins of his manuscripts. Now, contrary to what I did in Mes Béatitudes, which was to pick up my own failed musical ideas, what I did in this work, in Rouscousse, was to rework all of the random little notes that I wrote in the margins of my own documents, in the margins of my diary, the margins of my musical notebooks. Often I write down little things that interest me in the margins. So in this piece, Rosicrucis, I picked up this idea of a narrative auto-fictional form, what I guess you could call a biographème. I created this piece with ideas that do in fact not come from my own, that are not my own, but they're so altered that you can't recognize them. When you create your own speech, your own musical speech, you first begin by creating a pidgin language, a language which doesn't belong to anyone, a language which comes up as a kind of synthetic bridge between two languages. This is something that two people develop when they don't have a common language. So first you develop a pidgin language, and then from that you move on to a creole, when the pidgin becomes a real language, a language which is forged on the basis of a pre-existing language. It's a kind of creolization of language. And this is something that can emerge in thought and music as well. This is rather complicated, but this creolization is something that I like to think about. So here's the last excerpt. Of course, I wanted to play more, but we've run out of time. It's always hard to time these things correctly. Here's the very beginning of Rosicrucis. First, you'll hear... What's happening here? What? What's going on?
Donc, il y a une construction séquentielle. Je vous dis.
There's a sequential structure in the piece. I'll let you know everything which is in it. I won't have you listen to the whole piece because it's very long. It's 25 minutes long. First, you hear one verse of poetry by Susan Ho, which is translated into French.
Hébreu pour passer une sorte de mot de cryptique pour passer une porte. Ensuite, une chanson d'Angleterre.
She uses the word shibboleth, a Hebrew word. Then there are a series of other quotations.
Une vieille chanson anglaise. Ensuite,
un rythme English ballad, in fact, from the 1830s. And then there's also a bit of Messiaen, and you'll hear a rhythmic fragment from Maurice Ravel, from Bolero. I think that you'll hear very clearly. And then there's a North African mode, a mode called Makam Dil. And then there's a welcome song from Ethiopia. Now, by hearing, I don't mean you actually hear it. You don't hear anything. But this is the musical material which is essentially underneath all the layering. Material which has been completely reshaped. Then you hear a passage in fourths and sixths. Then you'll hear a self-quotation from an opera that I was working on at the time based on the Orpheus legend, and then I'm lost in my pages here, so I don't know what else you hear, but you hear lots of things in any case.
Thank you.
rythme de Messiaen.
The Messiaen rhythm.
Le boléro de Ravel.
Bolero.
Et au centre de la partition, il y a une
in the middle part of the score, there's a type of transcription after Conlon Namcaro, who you all know, of course.
Lié à un programme de, qui avait
this transcription is there because this has to do with the commission of the work, which came from Cologne.
Aussi,
the commission had to do with mechanical music, which is also something I'm very interested in.
Il est évident que dans les
and given the idea of margins and things written in the margins, everything in Namcaro is in effect the margin, because for Namcaro the margin is the actual text itself. This particular recording was what you just heard was the Ensemble Moderne, but it is not released on CD because we haven't yet found a label for it. I've got a number of recordings up here. Thank you very much for your attention despite the late hour. Thank you.
Ça c'est en fait c'est Bruckner, enfin c'est
the score floating around here is Bruckner and myself. A summer vacation picture, Bruckner and I.